Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 159 for August 24th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes...
The gap we saw was for superb, rare finds of very old whiskey for people who want something unique and special as opposed to a standard brand that no matter what the price is.
That's James Espy, one member of the trio of whiskey veterans behind The Last Drop. Together, they've created some of the iconic brands in whiskey. Now they're tracking down casks of rare whiskeys left untouched for decades in Scottish distillery warehouses and bringing them to the world. More on The Last Drop in a few minutes. First, let's look at the news. Work on Diageo's massive new distillery at Rose Isle took another key step this past week. The last of the distillery's 14 stills was put into place. Construction is on track to be complete by the end of the year. When the distillery reaches full production, it'll be able to crank out 10 million liters of spirit a year. To put that into perspective, Diageo's current top producer is Dufton at 6 million liters a year. Still no word on deals for Glendronach, Glenmurray, or Tullibardine, but in the race to snap up distilling capacity, the Scotsman reports Brooke Laddie has been turning down offers from potential buyers right and left. The paper quotes Brooke Laddie managing director Mark Rainier as saying he's received at least 4 bids in the past year. All 4 have been turned down, and Rainier says he may even be in acquisition mode. Here in the States, it's political season. As I'm recording this, the Democrats are about to begin their convention in Denver, and the Republicans are a week away from their gathering in Minneapolis. Let's be honest now, politics and alcohol have been a natural combination for years, so the folks at Beam Global decided to ask Washington, D.C. area bartenders a few questions. Who tends to show up for happy hour first? 50% of the bartenders surveyed said Republicans, 48% said Democrats. Who stays the latest? 53% said the Democrats, 46% said Republicans. Which party is more likely to order their drinks straight up? 82% said Republicans, 14% said Democrats. By the way, Democrats led among the fruity drink crowd. And the most important question of all to a bartender, which party has the best tippers? 60% said Democrats, 38% said Republicans. I'll leave it to you to come up with your own explanation for that one. And if you're outside the U.S., substitute your local equivalent for Republican or Democrat, and you're probably not far off. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. First, a program note. I'll be taking WhiskeyCast on the road for special coverage of Whiskey Life Paris, sponsored by La Maison de Whiskey, the weekend of September 20th and 21st. If you're in Europe, I hope to see you there. There are still tickets available for the Whiskey Guild's Whiskies on the Hudson cruise in New York, September 10th. Milroy's of Soho in London will hold a tasting of whiskies from around the world that same night in London. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 16th through the 21st in Bardstown. There are still a few seats available for the whiskey blending class with John Glazer of Compass Box at the Astor Center in New York, September 18th. Whiskies of Scotland in Huntley will hold a Glenmorangie tasting on the 19th. And the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival runs 2 weekends, September 18th through the 20th and the 25th through the 27th. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig Quarter Cask. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay at laphroaig.com. Unless you work in the whiskey industry, you've probably never heard of James Espy or Tom Jago, but I'm almost willing to bet that you've enjoyed one of the brands they've been responsible for creating over the last 5 decades or so. Now in semi-retirement, James, Tom, and their partner Peter Fleck have created one last masterpiece. The Last Drop's first release is a blended scotch from whiskeys distilled in 1960 or so, blended in 1972, and then forgotten about for decades.
It's an anecdotal story. I am a shareholder in a small boutique hotel business in South Africa called The Last Word. And the owner of The Last Word worked with Tom and I. He, in fact, with Tom and I, developed and invented the brand called Malibu, which you've heard of, I'm sure.
Of course.
And when we were in South Africa, he asked me if I could find him 50 cases of a blended whiskey as The Last Word to give to his customers in his hotel. And then I thought there's a bigger idea here. So I came over to London and contacted my old friend Tom Jago, because Tom and I together had been the creator of Bailey's Irish Cream. And then in later life, we worked on Johnny Walker Blue Label and the classic malts, etc. So I said, come on, Tom, there's a big idea here. We had a brainstorming session.
Yeah, and it seemed it was a sensible and unexploited area where we could take otherwise unregarded quantities, small, tiny drops, half a barrel of old whiskey, bottle it up and say, quite truthfully, when we've sold what you've got, which is in our case 1,300 bottles, that's the last drop. This is the last drop of very ancient whiskey. The one we're selling at the moment is 48 years old, a blend, and it's a superb whiskey. And when it's gone, and that's the last drop. Then we will find another superb cask and sell it under the cover name brand, The Last Drop.
So the slogan of the company is, before there is no more. And the gap we saw was for superb, rare finds of very old whiskey for people who want something unique and special as opposed to a standard brand, no matter what the price is.
And as you mentioned, you both have been involved in some of the iconic brands in the whiskey business. Give us a sense of what all you have been both involved with over the years, because I know you've both been around the business for many, many years. What all have you created over the years between the two of you?
If you pass on to Tom, let me just say that the three of us together have, we call it 120 years of experience in a bottle, because that's our experience in this business. And I first met Tom when I joined the industry in 1970, and he was the head of innovation and a new product development at IDV, which then was the worldwide company, which became eventually Diageo. So Tom, tell us about your first brand.
Yeah, the first brand was actually something which is not so much known to the States, but very important in England, called Croft Pale Cream Sherry, which was a sherry based on the idea that pale whiskey, which we owned, J&B, was very popular, and we thought sherry was not popular, sherry was brown, and everyone was embarrassed drinking a brown drink. So we made a pale one, and it's now the leading brand, in fact the only significant brand of sherry in Britain. And then we went on to the development of Bailey's Irish Cream, which of course is a huge success at 7 million dozen a year.
Cases, yeah.
Sure. 7 million cases. World's biggest liqueur. That was created in the years 73 to 75, and is by far Ireland's biggest export. We subsequently annexed an idea from Peter Fleck in South Africa, which he called Coco Rico, and this was a coconut-flavored rum, white rum, very delicious, but he thought the name Coco Rico wasn't much good. He brought it to London. I had a name registered called Malibu, for a drink which had failed, and there are a lot of failures in our business, I can tell you. And we don't talk about them, and nobody takes credit for them. But the name Malibu stuck, and we put it on the bottle, and that's now a kind of $2 billion brand, too.
I think the point that we tried lots of things, some of them failed, we can tell you about failures all day, if you like, but Malibu was a brand invented really in South Africa in the midst of apartheid. We launched in England from a little factory in Essex. We didn't know how to give it an image, so we came up with a slogan with our agency. It comes from paradise and tastes like heaven. 20 years later, there's a factory in the Caribbean, in Barbados, and it's now a worldwide brand selling 3.2 odd million cases, and the brand is worth over £1 billion. So that was our IDV story. And then I moved to United Distillers, where I worked for a number of years, and I persuaded Tom, who had semi-retired by then, but he was still working for Hennessy Cognac, to come and join me. And then we decided we would invent a brand called Johnny Walker Oldest, which today is Blue Label.
And that was designed to refresh the image of Johnny Walker, which had been discounted to death in the Far East particularly, which is the most important market for it. This put the prestige back in it, and is now itself about a 3 million bottle brand.
And some.
So that was a step forward in building prestige brands. And then James and I both went to the Seagram Company.
Well, before that, we also launched the Classic Malt.
Oh, James launched the Classic Malt. Well, I had little to do with that. Not a bit. I did some of the packaging.
I think the point about the story is Tom and I have worked together for 40-odd years, and how it is, I'm a sort of, if you like, I paint the big picture, but Tom is the craftsman who puts in all the details and nuances and makes it happen. So we complement each other. My job is to kick the door down and persuade the directors to support us, because in most companies, as I'm sure you know, more people like to say no than like to say yes. So you have to overcome a lot of objections.
And nobody ever wanted any of the brands we created. I think it's true to say, James?
Absolutely. Bailey's failed in research, so Tom suppressed the research.
That's a fact, absolutely. We had focus groups in the estates and in the UK. Everybody hated it, said it tasted like Pepto-Bismol, never drink that stuff. So I just didn't report the research. We went ahead and did the test market, and it sold, and it went on selling.
And Malibu we never researched. Johnny Walker we never researched. Classic Malt we never researched. Then I left United Distillers and went across to Seagram. Now, Tom was fully retired by now.
I must interrupt you, though. Before you left United Distillers, you were the founder, creator, and driving force of the Keepers of the Quake, which is the most central organization representing Scotch whiskey to the world.
Now, well, wait a second. I have to stop you gentlemen for a second. I thought this was an organization you guys weren't allowed to talk about.
The Keepers of the Quake?
Yes.
We can. I invented it.
Okay. Then you can talk about it.
Talk about that very freely. It was a vision, an idea, to give honor and recognition to those who have made a significant contribution to the Scotch whiskey industry in one form or another. And so at that stage, I was with United Distillers. I sold it to the rest of the industry. We designed and choreographed it to do the best of British pomp and ceremony, which we're pretty good at in this nation. And we have you were inducted twice a year at Blair Castle, and there are now about 1,300-1,400 keepers from about 70 countries. And it's been a phenomenal success. It's a not-for-profit brand. It's a brand that honors Scotch whisky. Probably in many ways, it's the brand I'm most proud of.
It's very effective, and all the members are very honored and proud to be admitted to it, and not very many get in.
But if we move on from there, then I went across to Seagram. My great friend Ed MacDonald persuaded me to join Seagram as the head of Shivers Brothers Worldwide and the president of the Shivers and Glenlivet Group. And I was there for 5 or 6 years, and I wanted to launch a brand Tom and I developed called Shivers Regal 18.
And James persuaded me to follow him again. I've had a very good career following in James' footsteps.
Well, I don't know about that. But Tom's a young man. He's only 83 now, and I've got a lot of more work for him to do, Mark. But anyway, the point is, when I was at Seagram, we tested, we searched Shivers Regal 18. We wanted the halo of the brand to help 12-year-old Shivers, which is the main driver. And Mr. Edgar Bronfman Sr. said to me, who got involved in the business after his son Edgar Jr. started playing movies with Universal Studios, etc., etc. So Sr. came back into the business. I got the support of his son and the chief executive, Steve Callagher. But, of course, Sr. said, no, we won't have a Shivers Regal 18. There's only one Shivers Regal 12. I stood up to him, disagreed with him. I fell on my sword and got fired, which is Seagram style, in 1998. So the point of this story is that today, by the way, Shivers Regal 18, since acquired by Pernod Ricard, is a phenomenal success. It sells 250,000 cases, and they've now launched Shivers Regal 25. Anyway, we move on from there. I was then 55 years of age and decided I wouldn't work for any large company again, because you're a hired gun, and once you're gone, the king is dead, long live the king. So I've had a plural career for the last 10 years. And today I'm a consultant and a director of White Mackay Limited, who own Isle of Jura and Dalmore, amongst other brands. And they gave me permission to do my own thing, because when I came up with the last drop distillers and with Tom, I sought their permission because I didn't want there to be a conflict of interest. And they saw it as something interesting, unique. And Tom and I said, listen, this is the first time in our lives that we are going to do something for ourselves. And we have a philosophy which I call our four-legged table philosophy. We only work with people we like. We must add value and be seen to add value. We must have fun and make a little money. And if we can achieve that, that's a balanced four-legged table.
I think it's worth going back to the word fun, because if anything, if the drink industry is about anything, it's about fun. If you aren't having fun doing it, you can go and be a hedge funder or something. But I've had fun all the time I've been in since 63, and I'm still having a lot of fun.
So we decided to do something for ourselves. And then there was a question of finding rare parcels. And we managed to find some interesting parcels of very old whiskey. And quite frankly, without saying it too strongly, we were absolutely gobsmacked by our first release. And the analogy I use is as follows. I'm a great fan of single malts. But single malts are one note from one instrument. The world loves single malts, and that's great. A blend is a total orchestral symphony. A good conductor can pick out a bad note. A good blender can pick out a bad note. We stumbled across three actual barrels of a whiskey that had been blended 36 years ago from 82 different whiskeys. That is 70 malts.
They were all 12 years old when they were blended.
12 or older than 12.
That's right.
70 malts or 12 grains. They were put into new sherry wood and left to sleep for 36 years. And when Tom tasted them, what was your reaction?
Well, I thought it was way beyond Scotch. It's really beginning to converge with the taste of very old cognacs in a way. Marvellous wood, marvellous fragrance, and we were astonished. A fortnight ago, we came to the States for a few days to talk to people and our agents about importing it. And all the people we showed it to, journalists, wine writers, and the trade, shopkeepers and so on, all tasted it and admired it as much as we do. We were really very gratified by the reaction. The idea of the thing at such a price and such rarity is curious to us, but the fact that they all agreed and loved it. Some of them said it's too cheap. James just pointing out to me that now, as always, if you're doing something right, you wish you asked for more. If you sell a car, you say, well, I could have gotten another $1,000 on that.
But the malt advocate gave us a rating the other day. We saw John Hansel, and he gave us a rating of 95, which is what, and he gave a rating to another brand of the same day, which sells for $6,000. They got a 94 rating. And we have another rating coming up from a UK whiskey judge company. I can't mention it yet, but it's an astonishing rating, and it beats Royal Salute, which they rate at, which sells at £6,000, and Royal Salute 50-year-old, £6,000, got a rating lower than the one we believe we're going to get. So it's fun. It's unique. It will be in very limited distribution in the US. One retailer in New York, one in Chicago, one in LA, and then selectively around the US.
The only problem is going to be keeping up the quality, because we've got to go around snuffing out with our friends what's still left in the corners of the whiskey warehouses of Scotland.
So that's
this will be sold all over the world in limited markets, of course, correct?
Very small quantities, you know, 10 bottles in one country and 15 in another. And, you know, it's in duty-free at all the London airports at the moment and selling well. And we were very proud to see it there when we boarded the plane to New York.
I mean, in the US, our retail position point is $2,000. We think probably that's seriously undervalued. We've had a couple of write-ups in the UK where they say this product's going to go up in value, because obviously it's limited in quantity. If you create a brand like Blue Label, which is a fantastic brand, but it comes off the production line, there will always be a Blue Label. In the last drop, when it's finished, it's rather like Chateau Petrus or some other first-growth clarets. When there's no more, there's no more. So the fun is the rarity. The fun is limited distribution. We've turned away some distributors who want to represent us.
And the fun is the taste, too. I must say that we are, and others confirm this, really very impressed with the way this whiskey tastes, which is, as James said, a symphony of flavors, much more than any one malt. And I'm a great admirer of malts. I love it. But this one contains so many different virtues of the wood and the whiskey, that it's a great pleasure. And a rare treat for anybody to get one.
In reading some of the materials about this particular blend, it turns out that I read that many of the distilleries that provided whiskeys for this blend are no longer in existence. Can you tell me some of the distilleries that are no longer there, that people would recognize that contributed to this blend?
Off the top of my head, I can send you the information. But for example, there are 12 grains in this blend. There are only 7 grain distilleries left.
One of the ones which was most contributing to the flavor was Royal Bracknell, which ceased to exist in the late 60s. And there are many like this. I'm awfully sorry I haven't got them on the top of my head. But I should have thought out of the 70 whiskies in there, probably 20 of them no longer distill. New ones are beginning to spring up now. People are building new distilleries, all the open old ones. But that was the case. These are truly the last drop.
I think the point to make is what happens in the industry, Mark, is everybody swaps stock. They all swap stock in order to give their blends a balance. So people have old barrels they've been holding for years, and then the distillery stops production or goes out of production, and they've still got these old whiskies, and they use them. Now, some distilleries are being reopened because there's a run on Scotch at the moment. Largely fueled by a demand from Asia for 12-year-old, Scotch whiskey is suddenly regaining its preeminent position, which it lost for a few years because it wasn't marketed positively enough, and there was more supply than there is demand. Now there's a shortage of Scotch, and a lot of distilleries are opening up that have been mothballed.
While we're talking about the current state of the industry, does it surprise you that people are willing to pay so much money for really classic old whiskeys now, especially given the worldwide boom when you've got people in Russia, China, some of the other emerging markets, that people are willing to pay thousands of dollars for a good bottle of whiskey?
It seems to be happening to a gentleman from China came to one of the distillery shops that stocks our brother in Scotland a couple of weeks ago, and he saw it and bought two bottles straight away. Just, I used his American Express card and got $4,000 worth of whiskey in his bag.
Well, he fell in love with the miniatures.
Yeah, he loved the miniatures. The bottle comes in a box. Very simple, because we reckon the kind of people who buy this stuff got their own decanters, got their own cabinets and stuff. We can't supply better. But we thought that the whiskey is the essence of the thing, the values inside the bottle. We provide a bottle, which if you're a collector, you can keep the bottle intact, sealed with wax. And we provide a 50-milliliter miniature, you know, standard miniature, also sealed with wax. So you can drink that, have a good drink, it's a double dram, and then know what it tastes like before you open the main bottle and ruin your speculation. Another thing we ought to tell you is it's in the Glen Eagles Hotel in Scotland bar at
$380 a 50 ml tot in Glen Eagles, the world famous Glen Eagles Hotel, where the G8 conference was held about 5 years ago. So they've just listed us. I'm hoping to have listings in two other five-star hotels in London. I can't mention them yet. And then I'll stop. I don't want any more than three of the top hotels world recognized in the UK to carry the last drop.
If your friends are in England or Britain, it's available in a small group of shops called the Whiskey Shop. And they have it exclusively for England.
But in America, it'll be exclusively through a number of key outlets.
Yes. Park Avenue Liquors.
Vinny's in Chicago. Wally's in L.A., for example.
Give me your take on the current state of the industry after being around it for so long. When we talk about the worldwide run on whiskey that we've got right now, where do you see the industry headed in the next few years?
Give you two answers. First of all, let me come back to your point about luxury and paying for luxury. I personally, as an individual, I think that the recession we're facing now is probably quite a good thing. I think that the world has gone crazy. I think people have been paid far too much money for speculating and borrowing, etc., etc. So whilst it's hurting all of us, myself included, I hope we'll get some better values in our society. Now, having said that, there are some seriously wealthy people. When I was a kid, we spoke about millionaires. Millionaires are two a penny. Anyone who's got $1 million is a millionaire. We don't have billionaires now. And so the very rich people, if a man's wealth drops from $500 million to $400 million, I don't think it matters a row of beans which whiskey he drinks. He drinks what he wants to drink. He still drives his Bentley motor car. He still buys his wife his Louis Vuitton handbags or whatever they may be. He stays in the best hotels in New York and London or wherever it is. So consequently, people, the last drop is aimed at someone who's either a collector or a connoisseur or someone who wants to have something unique, frankly, to impress his friends. They're the three target markets. Those people don't go away. We're not aimed at Joe Public. We're not aimed at Tom Jager or James Espy. We can't afford to drink it ourselves, except occasionally when we're lucky. But in principle, it's aimed at people who want something unique, rather like the person who'll go and buy a bottle of Chateau Petrus from a retail store and pay $3,000. So I have no doubt about that.
Or buy a famous work of art, which is in a sense this stuff is. I think the whiskey industry is going through a period of what you might call creative shortage. The stuff is short because mainly China is buying huge quantities of aged whiskey, especially 12-year-olds. Therefore, because the cycle of production in whiskey is slow, you can't make 12-year-old whiskey to order. You've got to wait 12 years for it. And therefore, there's a slow cycle in the production and demand, and there's always going to be periods of oversupply and undersupply. And we're in a period of undersupply at the moment and boom of sales. I think supply will catch up, the sales boom will be satisfied, but I think in the next 10 years we shall see the whiskey market worldwide expand enormously. And the sort I hope the profitability of it, I hope they don't take the opportunity to discount everything down again.
I don't think that will happen. I mean, I think, Mark, what's happened is unfortunately in the last 10 years, people started discounting Scotch, and Scotch lost some of its cachet. Now, in any political spectrum around the world, whenever a market opens up politically and becomes a free market, it's amazing how Scotch whiskey becomes the drink of choice. They move from the local product to Scotch. America has always been slightly different, because America was a monstrously big Scotch market, the world's number one. Scotch declined in America when rums and vodkas took off. Smirnoff and Bacardi led that wave. But at the premium end, it's coming back. In Asia, 12-year-old is the standard that people want. South America's 12-year-old as well. And so if you are short of whiskey and you've got lots of stock of 6-year-old, you're not going to sell it to anyone. You're going to wait till it gets to 12. So I think we've got 5 or 6 years where there will be a shortage of Scotch, and then production will catch up because people are distilling furiously.
I have to ask, Mr. Espy, since you're working with White and Mackay as well, it would be stupid of me not to ask, what do you think of Mr. Malia's work with the company so far?
I think he's a very impressive individual, Mr. Malia. Yes, he's a very flamboyant man. He makes Richard Branson of Virgin look like a beginner, I think. But I think in context, he's a man with a lot of vision. Now, I don't have a lot of dealings with him. He's a visionary. He clearly wants to build a serious liquor company. In India, United Spirits is the dominant company. They sell 60 million cases plus there. He also owns Kingfisher Beer, which is a big Indian brand. He owns Kingfisher Airlines, which will be flying into the United States next year, I believe. So his vision is a big global vision. I think this is just the beginning. And what's happened is he's acquired White Mackay. He's digesting White Mackay. There's a new management team that's come in. It's being reconstructed. Obviously, there's a new board, and I'm privileged to sit on the board of White Mackay Limited. And I think we're going to see basically, White Mackay is now in strong hands for the first time in its life, because previously it had 4 or 5 owners in 20 years. So whilst plans, these things take time. I tell people in the industry, there's never been a spirits brand in the history of the liquor industry built successfully in less than 10 years. The closest to an exception might be Grey Goose, by the late Sidney Frank, who was a marketing genius. So I think Dr. Malia, you'll hear a lot more about Dr. Malia in the liquor industry, and White Mackay has got exciting plans, but they will take time to evolve, because this is not a quick-fix business.
When he talks about putting flavorings into Scotch whiskey, what do you come back with when you talk to him about this?
And I think that a lot of what Dr. Malia says, if I may say, and I don't mean this in the wrong sense, he stirs the pot. He challenges the status quo. You know, he's got two interests. He's got Indian. He's got, his bigger moneymaker is United Spirits. And quite frankly, in India, for example, you can buy McDowell's whiskey or Bagpiper whiskey. Whiskey in India is made from molasses. It's molasses-flavored whiskey. The debate that the Indians have is, can they sell their whiskey outside of India, leaving all Indian companies? The answer is you can sell your whiskey outside if it's made from grain spirits, if it's made from local malt, and if it's called whiskey. If it's Indian whiskey, it must be called Indian whiskey. If it's in a Scotch-type name, it must be Scotch. So those are issues. So he's always pushing the edge. And I think that he was enjoying challenging the audience in Scotland, and you rightly have picked up on it.
And back to the last drop. What's next now that you've got the first bottling out?
Well, let's just say this. We haven't got all of the first bottling out. We are releasing it very carefully, right? At this stage, we have sold about 600 bottles out of our 1,347 bottles. We have allocated 350 to the United States. We're working with a wonderful people called Infinium Spirits, who are part of Young's Market, and they couldn't be nicer people to deal with because they share the values that we have, which is long-term, have fun, and do it right, rather than try and sell it quickly. We hope we might be able to find a little bit more for the United States in 2009. At the same time, Tom in particular, who's the expert in this area, we're looking at other casks that we would release next. And what do we do for an encore is the challenge.
And it's going to be very difficult. We set ourselves a very high bar to jump over, and nobody's going to be happy if we come up with something which is even faintly second rate. I don't believe we can possibly say, this is not quite so good that you can have it for a mere $1,000. That's not going to convince people. But we've got wide plans for possibly later on doing other premium liquids such as cognacs and things, but we're not seriously counting on that at the moment. We've got to choose from the available beautiful whiskies that are out there, usually almost unknown. The thing is, this blend was probably part of a batch which got sold off as a brand back in 1972, gone. And somebody forgot three casks and they sat there and aged. We were lucky to pick them up because we have the friends. And the same will exist again. I'm tasting whiskey all the time of this sort and talking to my friends in the industry. And I'm confident we have plenty to come, maybe smaller quantities, even just a couple of hundred, but with the quality we seek.
But I can say this. In the year 2010, we will release something absolutely unique, that I will say. There will only be a couple of hundred bottles. It'll be priced at the very top end. It'll be the ultimate collector's piece. We've got reserves. We've got some stocks we're looking at to release at the end of next year. But we're taking our time because we're not in a hurry. The nice thing about it is we're doing it for ourselves. I'm sitting in my garden and outside of my house looking outside. This is Tom and I, two friends with Peter in South Africa, our third partner. We're not in a hurry. Money doesn't motivate us.
We have no targets to meet.
No targets to meet. Money doesn't matter. It's not about money. We'll make a little money. That'll be fun. So we will find more unusual and interesting things. And the Last Drop Distillers Limited will always be the brand. The company will be the brand. And then it'll be releasing something rare, unique, and in limited quantities. So what's the space, as they say?
I've talked a lot on WhiskeyCast about passion and how it drives many of the people in this business. And like most fields, once you get the whiskey bug, it just never seems to go away. James Espy and Tom Jago are proof of that. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. You'll find links, ratings, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.